Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, mass arrests in Brazil after thousands stormed government buildings in support of the defeated far-right president.
President Biden meets with his counterpart in Mexico City as the U.S. announces a strategy shift at the southern border.
And Navy veteran Mark Frerichs describes being held hostage in Afghanistan in his first ever television interview.
They may have stole nearly 3 years of my life, but I wasn't going to let them steal my soul and spirit.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. It was the most serious assault on Latin America's largest democracy in decades.
Supporters of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro stormed the center of power in Brazil's capital, demanding the military take over and evict current President Lula da Silva. More than 1,500 people have been arrested. And today, Bolsonaro, who is currently in Florida, was admitted to the hospital. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
In Brazil's capital today, riot police showed up in force and sent in the cavalry to try to dismantle the movement fueled by former President Jair Bolsonaro. Yesterday, they launched a frontal assault on Brazil's democracy. They rampaged through Congress, hoping to reinstall Bolsonaro. They assaulted the presidential palace and occupied it, hoping the military would overthrow the new inhabitant, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. They assaulted police officers who tried to resist, and they ransacked the Supreme Court and stole an official chair and a symbol of the state. 2 years and 2 days since the January 6th riot in Washington, the echoes were overt, a violent attempt to undo an election in the name of a losing candidate who claimed fraud.
Military intervention is what we're asking for, period. There is no going back. We're not leaving here.
They kept it up, even as they were arrested.
This is an injustice. There are no criminals here. We were just protesting. We want to save the country.
Authorities blame public security officials and ousted Brasilia's governor and the head of the capital's security. President Lula called the rioters, quote, fanatic fascists who committed terrorist acts.
They will all pay with the force of law for this irresponsible, undemocratic gesture, this gesture of vandals and fascists.
Bolsonaro never accepted defeat in October's election, but did not try to stop transition. Yesterday, he tweeted, peaceful demonstrations are part of democracy, but violence such as that occurred today escape the rule. Bolsonaro remains in Florida on a visa he obtained while still president. Today, the State Department suggested he would need to leave or apply for a new visa within 30 days.
It would be incumbent on the visa holder to take that action, either to depart the United States or to request that change in status.
The U.S. also promises to cooperate with any Brazilian request for assistance in its investigation and reply to any Brazilian extradition request. To discuss this more, I'm joined by Gustavo Flores Macias, professor of government and public policy and associate vice provost for international affairs at Cornell University. Thanks very much. Welcome to the NewsHour. Bolsonaro's been saying that the election is rigged. He's been calling for his supporters to take over Congress, to take over the Supreme Court. Was yesterday a culmination of his efforts to delegitimize his own defeat?
I think that's right. I think yesterday showed the danger of undermining the credibility of the elections. And, you know, we've seen this in the U.S. Now we're seeing this in Brazil. It's very clear that to a large sector of the population in Brazil, Lula is not the legitimate president. And this is in great part because of the concerns that Bolsonaro among the population during the campaign, after the first round of election, and even after the second round, he refused to concede. So what we're seeing right now is a direct consequence of that. And trust in elections is very difficult to rebuild. I think this will take quite a bit of time for Brazil to recover.
Yeah, and does this go beyond even the election? You know, in this country, we talk about how Donald Trump's no longer president, but his ideas are part of the mainstream. Are Bolsonaro's ideas here to stay in Brazil?
I think that's right. And one very concrete way in which we will see his ideas endure is through Congress. Parties aligned with Bolsonaro actually did quite well and have a majority in Congress. There will be a strong conservative sector, a strong right-wing contingent of parties in Congress. And it'll be fairly difficult for President Lula to govern without trying to accommodate these positions to some extent.
Obviously, some of these challenges to democracies put pain and pressure on the institutions of the democracies. It appears yesterday that the institutions held. Can they continue to hold in Brazil?
It has been an important test for Brazil's democratic institutions. I think these pressures will continue throughout the Lula administration. If anything, they might become more and more frequent. It'll be important to see what the new administration does to, let's say, address the situation and to punish, make sure that there's punishment so that this doesn't happen again. Otherwise, supporters of Bolsonaro, if there's not a strong response, they might be emboldened and they may attempt sort of more drastic measures in the future. But what we saw yesterday is that the specter of a military coup may be alive and well in Brazil. There was a coup in 64, the military was in power for about two decades. And what we saw is that a lot of these people participating in the riots were proactively sort of very, very outspoken in terms of inviting the military to step in to try to resolve the situation.
And to your point about punishment, it seems that in the past, Brazil has tolerated some of the extreme right. Could this lead Brasilia to do something it hasn't done before, which is rein it in?
So the silver lining that could emerge out of this is that in the eyes of some sectors, perhaps the most centrist sectors in Brazilian society, the far right will be very discredited, right? They're playing with fire here. It may be that perhaps they were willing to accommodate these sectors before, and now they may not be willing to tolerate that. During the Bolsonaro administration, there was an intense militarization of public life, and hopefully in Congress and the new administration will have very little tolerance for that, and that'll resonate among the sectors of society that used to tolerate these actions and that will hopefully have very little tolerance for that in the future.
Let's zoom out a little bit regionally. We have seen strains on other democracies. We are also seeing rising polarization. How important is Brazil's internal response to democracy across the region?
Brazil is not only a regional leader, but sort of even in the world stage, it's very important what Brazil does. There are countries around the Southern Cone, and if we think of just Latin America in general, you know, places like Peru or Ecuador, where there's a lot of political friction, a lot of political instability right now. And people are watching closely. And it is important for democratically elected governments around the region to close ranks and express support behind President Lula to make sure that this doesn't happen again in Brazil or anywhere else in the region.
And how significant is this, even more zoomed out, in the global context of right-wing populism and threats to democracy?
We see that right-wing parties, especially extreme right-wing parties around the world, are adopting some of the tactics, some of the strategies that we've seen, say, in the U.S. From places like in Spain, where the far-right party Vox is adopting a lot of the same slogans, or same in Hungary. So we're likely to see more of this, unfortunately, not less. And as long as polarization continues to increase around the world, we're likely to continue to see these situations.
Professor Gustavo Flores Macias, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.
And the White House now says that President Biden spoke with Brazilian President Lula this afternoon to convey his support, and they agreed Lula would visit Washington in early February.
In the day's other headlines, California is confronting new storms blowing in from the Pacific with seemingly no end in sight. They follow a parade of powerful storm systems that are already blamed for 14 deaths. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
Flood warnings are in effect in major swaths of northern and central California. Some 10,000 residents of Montecito in Santa Barbara County, as well as 32,000 in Santa Cruz, are under evacuation warnings. Sacramento City Unified was among several school districts that canceled classes. More than 135,000 California customers were without power as of Monday afternoon. Meteorologists are predicting the storm could lead to $1 billion in damages. Many residential areas are in shambles. Trees have fallen on cars and blocked roads.
Power went out. I'd gone upstairs with a flashlight, and all of a sudden I heard a very loud concussion, and I knew right then this tree had fallen over.
A fallen branch killed a woman in Sacramento last night. California's Governor Gavin Newsom encouraged people to stay home in a safety briefing yesterday.
And that's the imperative that we're trying to express here, is the seriousness of purpose in terms of just being safe and being thoughtful. Use your common sense.
Californians are counting their losses after a series of days of relentless rain and historic snowfall, including business owner Dominic King.
It's our family restaurant. You know, we've had it for like a decade. It's definitely places where we've had a lot of great memories. It's more than just a business. So it's really hard to see it kind of in the state that it's in, right?
The treacherous weather is not expected to let up until later this week. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Officials say the storms have not ended California's long-running drought, but have helped ease dry conditions and replenish water supplies. The Justice Department is reviewing a batch of potentially classified documents found in President Joe Biden's former institute. The White House said today that a, quote, small batch of documents with classified markings were discovered as Biden's personal attorneys were clearing out the offices of the Penn Biden Center, where the president kept an office after he left the vice presidency. A special grand jury in Georgia has finished investigating whether former President Donald Trump and his allies committed crimes trying to overturn the 2020 election. A judge in Atlanta dissolved the grand jury panel today. There's a hearing later this month on whether to make its report public. The local district attorney will decide whether to seek indictments based on the findings. The U.S. House of Representatives is facing a new fight tonight after last week's showdown over selecting a speaker. This time, the issue will be the rules governing the chamber for the next 2 years. Newly minted House Speaker Kevin McCarthy must wrangle support from GOP hardliners and moderates, as some of the moderates are questioning the concessions he made to far-right lawmakers to win his post. Iran sentenced three more anti-government protesters to death today after hanging two men on Saturday. The country's courts said at least four condemned protesters have been executed since September. At the Vatican today, Pope Francis broke his silence over Iran's protests and condemned the executions.
The death penalty cannot be employed for a purported state justice, since it does not constitute a deterrent nor render justice to victims, but only fuels the thirst for vengeance. I appeal, then, for an end to the death penalty, which is always inadmissible since it attacks the inviolability and the dignity of the person.
Despite the papal appeal, Iran's supreme leader signaled the country has no intention of softening its position. On the war in Ukraine, Russia rejected Kyiv's claim that Moscow is floating a possible peace deal with European officials. A Kremlin spokesman called it, quote, another fake, and Russian attacks continued without letup. A rocket strike near Kharkiv left a large crater after hitting a market. Ukrainian officials said it killed two women and wounded at least five other people. Dozens of countries and institutions pledged more than $9 billion today to help Pakistan recover from catastrophic floods. The unprecedented summer deluge killed more than 1,700 people and destroyed more than 2 million homes. Floodwaters are still receding across many parts of the country. And back in this country, police in Newport News, Virginia, are still trying to figure out what drove a 6-year-old boy to shoot his first-grade teacher. That teacher, 25-year-old Abby Zwerner, remained hospitalized today in stable condition. The police chief said she had no warning of the attack.
Mrs. Zwerner was providing class instruction. The 6-year-old child displayed a firearm, pointed it at her, and fired one round. She took a defensive position where she raised her hand. The round went through her hand, exited the rear of her hand, and into her upper chest.
The chief called Zwerner a hero who managed to shepherd her students to safety before receiving first aid. Thousands of nurses went on strike today at two major privately owned hospitals in New York. They began walking picket lines after contract negotiations stalled. Their demands include better staffing and higher salaries after nearly 3 years of the pandemic. The hospitals, Mount Sinai in Manhattan and Montefiore in the Bronx, have postponed non-emergency surgeries and diverted ambulances to other facilities. NFL player DeMar Hamlin is back in Buffalo tonight for the first time since he suffered cardiac arrest during a game a week ago. Hamlin was transferred from a hospital in Cincinnati to one in Buffalo today. He tweeted that he's happy to be back. Doctors say Hamlin is now able to walk and is undergoing therapy. And on Wall Street, stocks struggled to find much direction. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 113 points to close at 33,517. The NASDAQ rose 66 points. The S&P 500 slipped by three. And still to come on the NewsHour, Republicans wrangle over which rules will govern the House of Representatives. The CDC warns of rising strep throat infection among children, and the true story behind one of the most damaging spies in American history.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, President Biden and his Mexican and Canadian counterparts kicked off a summit where migration will be a key issue. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador greeted President Biden in Mexico City this evening ahead of that bilateral meeting. The talks come after President Biden made his first visit to the southern border since taking office. Yesterday, he joined Border Patrol agents in El Paso, Texas, and met with migrant advocates and local officials. Our White House correspondent, Laura Barone Lopez, is following all of this and joins me here. Good to see you.
Good to be with you.
So obviously that meeting between President Biden and President López Obrador, we know migration and immigration is going to be a key issue. What else is on the agenda and what is the White House hoping to get out of these meetings?
So National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan today said that the three biggest issues are going to be about cracking down on fentanyl trafficking, trade, supply chains, and then that third one is migration and migration enforcement. And recently Mexico said that they would take some 30,000 migrants per month from Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela. And a part of the discussions today, Jake Sullivan said, could be that they might be willing to take even more than that 30,000 per month.
So we know that advocate community, the nonprofits, church groups on the ground, they play a key role in terms of being on the front lines, receiving a lot of those migrant populations. President Biden met with some of them. What do we know about those conversations and what they want from the White House?
So I spoke to multiple immigrant advocates who met with Biden yesterday, and they said that they're concerned that this new parole program makes it so migrants are going to have to stay in their country and apply for asylum from there, and that migrants can't afford to wait. I spoke to Ruben Garcia, the director of the Annunciation House today, and who helps migrants on both sides of the border. And he had this to say about the sheer number of Venezuelans coming to the border.
You know, I've been doing this for 45 years. This is the first time that I have seen as many individuals from one country that have no or very, very few sponsors to receive them. We cannot simply dig a hole and stick our head in that hole and think that it's going to go away. We're going to see more individuals fleeing their country, and I mean fleeing their country.
And so Ruben Garcia, in addition to Catholic Bishop Mark Sice, who I also spoke to, said that their message to the president as well as White House aides yesterday was that they're hoping that the White House could, the administration could provide a 48-hour window where those undocumented Venezuelans and a number of other migrants who are, they said, stuck in El Paso could turn themselves into authorities and not be reassured that they would not then be deported to Mexico or to another country. But the president and his aides told them yesterday that their hands are tied by the courts.
So these groups are clearly feeling very, very taxed. We also know those border frontline officials, they are severely taxed, right? The folks who are responsible for apprehending folks, for processing them, for enforcing the border, what do they want to see from the White House right now?
So the law enforcement source that I spoke to, who works closely with Border Patrol officers, said that they're stretched insanely thin right now. It's, quote, like controlled chaos, and that ultimately, you know, they need more resources, that they're having to do humanitarian work that they aren't trained for. And so they, as well as immigrant advocates, ultimately say that the only thing that is going to fix this long term is going to be a comprehensive immigration bill.
And tell me about that. How likely are we to see comprehensive immigration reform from Congress?
So, in short, Amna, we're very unlikely to see it. There was a bipartisan group of senators in El Paso today, so there might be some appetite among the Senate. In the House, there could very well be one Republican in Texas, Tony Gonzalez, who had this to say about immigration.
If this insurgency caucus decides to put anti-immigrant legislation on the floor and masquerade it as border security policy, that's not going to fly. And okay. I will do everything in my power to make sure that type of legislation fails on the floor.
So Tony Gonzalez could very well be one House Republican that the White House could work with, but ultimately there's no indication that House Republicans are going to go along with Senate Republicans and work with the White House on a big deal.
Certainly a topic I know you will be tracking along with many, many others. Our White House correspondent, Laura Barrón López, good to see you.
Thank you.
In a first big test of Kevin McCarthy's speakership, the House is voting on a controversial rules package that will set the procedural plans for this new Congress. The package includes concessions McCarthy made in closed-door deals with Republican hardliners to help get him elected speaker, concessions that many worry could lead to more gridlock. To walk us through all this, I'm joined by our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins. So, Lisa, Republicans have a speaker, but the House can't really get down to work until the chamber passes this set of operating rules. The all-important question these days appears to be, do they have the votes?
This is the first big test of this Republican new House. And I will say that going into today, we knew, of course, that the Freedom Caucus folks who negotiated these rules, they liked the bent. They like how much it changes the House. But there is a question mark over tonight's vote. And that comes in part from moderates who were upset they didn't have a seat at the table. They haven't seen all of these changes necessarily. Here's Republican Nancy Mace of South Carolina speaking yesterday.
Okay. I represent a purple district. I have to represent Republicans, Democrats, and independents. I want to know that the positions that I have are going to have a voice, that it will have weight in the conference. There are a lot of members like me that have issues with some of the policies that we're going to be working on.
Now, just in the past hour or so, it is our understanding that actually Representative Mace has decided that she will vote yes tonight. That is a big yes vote and a relief to, I think, probably Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans. Some like Chip Roy, who was known as the opponent of McCarthy, who kind of got these rules going. He spoke on the Glenn Beck radio show today about what he sees as the importance, what his philosophy is behind these rules.
But we're doing what we can, we think, to move the needle in this town towards openness and a sense that we're going to try to do the work of the American people and empower your congressmen, not just a few people, to be able to execute for them.
Right. So this is a real question of how this Republican conference can get along, if they can get along this vote coming up. You know, right now, Jeff, my sources indicate they think that they will have this vote, but predicting the direction of this body, I've been telling people, is a bit like predicting the direction of a group of very loosely tethered huskies that don't seem to have a musher. So we will see this vote when we see it.
So, Lisa, we've talked about this critical rules package before, but help us understand why this holdup over it matters.
Right. These specific rules, there's a 55-page document that we have seen. There's another 3-page document in secret that has been going around that contains some concessions that are not public and are not all the way known. So let's talk about the things that we don't know yet. One of those, we don't know the exact requirement for raising the debt ceiling. That will be a major factor in your life and my life and the country's life as we hit that debt ceiling deadline, likely at the beginning of the summer. There also is not a clear standard for the exact scale of spending cuts that Republicans are saying they agree to amongst themselves. And then finally, we don't know the extent of the influence of the Freedom Caucus on the committees and on what committees. One thing that we did learn today, Byron Donalds, someone who made a name for himself of Florida as one of the alternate candidates for speaker, we know that he has been placed on the all-important steering committee. I know we're talking about so much process here, Jeff, but that really is the committee that decides who goes where, who gets what power within the House Republican committee structure. So clearly here, there was some kind of a sense of reward for him and a big foothold for those he represents, which are those sort of opponents, those folks who are watchful of Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. Lisa, as you well know, there are lawmakers who say that these concessions increase transparency around how major legislation comes together. But there are also lawmakers who say that these concessions basically bake in dysfunction to make it difficult for the House to do pretty much anything. Give us a sense. What are the sort of pros and cons of the Republican approach here?
It's so important to stress that. There are many Republicans and Democrats who would like a more open House, who would like 72 hours before a bill is seen. Kind of go back to the days in the early 19th century when there was vigorous open debate on the floor. Some believe that that could be good, as well as some of the fiscal things they have in here, more amendments to cut spending. But let's look at sort of some of the other, the one major issue here with the national debt. In 2013, the national debt, $11.5 trillion. Now, look at that, $24.5 trillion. This is the issue. That's about 95% of our GDP. So while these maneuvers seem like they would allow for more spending cuts, one issue is they could also motivate, and there's more incentive here, for cutting taxes. That is something that adds more red ink. So on the one hand, it's this. On the other, it's that. And it's also not clear if the Republican Party in the House will be able to control itself and be disciplined about getting these things done together.
Lisa Desjardins joining us from Capitol Hill tonight. Lisa, thanks.
You're welcome.
As House Republicans get to work, one member in particular is coming under increased scrutiny. A campaign watchdog group filed a complaint today with the Federal Election Commission accusing newly sworn-in Congressman George Santos of illegally using campaign funds to pay personal expenses and of masking the true source of those funds. The complaint marks the latest potential legal trouble for the New York Republican, who has admitted that he lied about his family history, his resume, his education, all following a bombshell report by the New York Times last month. But the Times wasn't the first to report on Santos's fabricated biography. A small local paper on Long Island called the North Shore Leader broke the Santos scandal before the November election. By the time other outlets picked it up, Santos had already been elected. Grant Lally is the publisher of the North Shore Leader, and he joins us now. It's great to have you here. And your paper back in September wrote about Santos's rise in his reported net worth from basically nothing in 2020 to some $11 million by 2022. An inexplicable rise was how your paper characterized it. How did your reporters catch on to this story?
Well, look, he was a prominent personality on while he was running for office, and we're pretty attuned to the political activities of folks on the North Shore. So a lot of people with the newspaper and a lot of people I knew outside the newspaper were following him and tracking him and looking at what his claims were. And what we all concluded was that he was a fraud. He was making things up and lying and boasting and putting people down, claiming he was such a rich man when he clearly wasn't. And so we all smelled a fake, and we started looking through his campaign finance reports, and we saw a lot there that looked fraudulent, really over the top fraudulent.
What's your theory for why other outlets didn't pick up your paper's reporting until after the election?
Well, I'll tell you, it was very disappointing that that didn't happen. We did send the paper out to a lot of the local organs, a lot of the media. But look, it was a busy year in New York. We had a very hotly contested gubernatorial election, which was within a few points, that dominated the news cycle. You also had a lot of other open congressional races in the neighboring districts. So a lot of the media got distracted in looking at really the bigger race, not the local races.
You are a lifelong Republican who ran three times for the New York 3 district seat, the seat that Santos now occupies. And your paper reluctantly endorsed a Democrat in the run-up to the election, saying of Santos, quote, "He boasts like an insecure child, but he's most likely just a fabulist, a fake."
We knew Santos was a fraud. We knew what he was claiming, what he was filing was fraudulent. And that is ultimately what's going to get him in trouble now. You know, he can lie about who he is, his religion. He can claim he's a Jewish descendant of Holocaust survivors. That stuff won't get you in jail. But when you file false reports with the House of Representatives and with the Federal Elections Commission, deliberately, willfully false reports, that's going to get you in jail. Every offense is a felony, and it'll get you 5 years in federal prison.
Your paper's reporting speaks to the importance of local journalism. This is an era we've seen hundreds of local papers close in recent years. The disappearance has left millions of people without access to vital local news. What do you see as the significance of your paper's reporting on Santos in that context?
Look, I've actually spoken to quite a few of the other local papers and their publishers and their owners around the area. I mean, they're very cheered by this development that we were able to break this story, and it is now a national story, unfortunately, but it is a national story, and we broke it. It has re-energized a lot of the local newsrooms here in New York, but also, I think, around the U.S. It's a tough business to be in, but it's also a niche because nobody else covers the local news in local communities like a local newspaper does.
Lastly, how are voters feeling about all of this, that their member of Congress effectively lied his way into his seat?
In the North Shore, in this third congressional district, they are furious, particularly the Republicans, because they feel that they were used. Santos took money from them. He took time from them. He got them into his scheme and got them to go out and talk to their friends. So they feel completely betrayed. And Democrats are outraged and, frankly, bewildered that they could lose to such a guy. The universal sentiment is that this is an outrage and that this guy's got to go.
Grant Lally is the publisher of the North Shore Leader. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been nearly 17 months since the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan. When they departed, they left an American behind. Contractor and U.S. Navy veteran Mark Frerichs was kidnapped and held hostage by Taliban forces for over 2.5 years. He was released as part of a prisoner swap last September and is now adjusting to freedom and life back in America. I went to Lombard, Illinois, where he's staying with family, to sit down with Mark in his first television interview since being freed.
You just have to be able to totally relax your body. And you just walk up from your toes to your head and just imagine your muscles relaxing from your toes, your ankles, up to your shins, your knees. You just talk yourself through your body. By the time it gets to your head, you can't feel your body. For me, anyway, I can't feel my body. My body is like a sleeping. So you're sleeping, but you're awake. Your brain is totally aware of what's going on in a room. And you can do whatever you want.
This is how 60-year-old Mark Frerichs says he survived 2.5 years held hostage in Afghanistan, busying his mind and body under brutal conditions.
Okay.
He's just marked 3 months of freedom back in his hometown, and he spoke exclusively to NewsHour in his first television interview.
Growing up here in Lombard, Illinois, did you dream about traveling the rest of the world?
Well, I was in the Navy for 5 years, and did a lot of traveling, and that kind of got me interested in what's going on in the rest of the world.
These are from your time in service too, right?
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, this is just stuff I got. I think I sent her from Afghanistan. Yeah, this is stuff they gave me.
He left the Navy in the mid-1980s, moved back to the Midwest, and became a contractor, building on his love of craftsmanship.
Look at that.
Solid oak, all oak.
Wait. You always put a secret compartment into what you build?
Secret compartment.
Why did you do that?
It's just my trademark when I build stuff.
As opportunities to build arose overseas after 9/11, Mark jumped at the chance, first to Iraq, then to Afghanistan in 2009, where he put his skills to good use.
You were there building things, is the simplest way to put it.
Building army garrisons for the ANA, Afghan National Army, mm-hmm. which included complete bases with hospitals, dining facilities, maintenance facilities, classroom facilities, office facilities, living quarters.
But you've always liked building things, right?
Yeah. Well, it's fulfilling to me to take nothing and turn it into something.
Life in Afghanistan was a world away from the one he grew up in, the middle son with two sisters, the shy kid who turned to magic as a way to connect with others. And over 10 years in country, he built a life. Before long, he was relaxed and up to his old tricks.
Beautiful. Good, good, good.
Did you ever think in your 10 years there I might get kidnapped?
No. No. Well, I mean, you can't not think about it.
Mark says he kept the same driver and security for 8 years. But in January of 2020, as he drove the familiar road from Kabul to Bagram Air Base to check on a construction project, the worst case scenario.
There's been a horrific accident. You believe your team is dead. You yourself are really badly injured, right? What is the moment that you realize this has gone horribly wrong? I think I'm getting kidnapped.
Well, I was laying in a ditch on the hood of the car, or the SUV. The windshield's completely knocked out. Everyone's standing around, nobody was helping me. I'm still thinking, well, maybe there's police or army here or something. Mm-hmm. Finally, they helped me up out of the ditch. So I'm thinking, well, these guys are gonna help me to the hospital.
What does it feel like in the moment?
I could barely walk. I was like half conscious, half not conscious. So they walked me, pretty much dragged me, and as they were dragging me, one of them, and these are words that I'll never forget, probably the worst words I've ever heard in my lifetime. Taliban good, America no good.
He says that to you?
Yeah, as he took my shoes and kicked me in the trunk. So that's when I knew for sure.
And they start driving?
Yeah.
How long were you in that trunk? Do you know?
At least 2 days.
Mark says he thought he was being taken towards the eastern Afghan city of Khost, known as a stronghold of the Taliban-aligned Haqqani group, who U.S. officials believe were holding him.
They bring me to this compound area, still just these four kids. I could tell that they were organizing things on the radio beforehand.
You call them kids? They're just young
men?
They
were just,
like teenagers?
Yeah, they were just teenagers.
With guns?
Early 20s. Teenagers with guns. Huh. And even if I could get away from these people, that where am I going to go? But I didn't know what they were going to do. I didn't know if they were just going to kill me or what they were going to do with me. So, and they seemed like they didn't know what to do with me. I think I caught them off guard or something.
U.S. officials tell the NewsHour they believe Mark may have been surveilled, but that the kidnapping on the heels of a horrific car crash was a crime of opportunity.
Mark, for most of your time in captivity, you're kept in what you've described as just a room with a dirt floor.
Yeah.
And very little else. What do you remember about what it felt like in that room?
Evil. Evil, cold, dank, or actually dry. It rained a few times, the roof leaked. There's mice running around. Had a bat flying around for a couple nights. Scorpions.
What did you sleep on every night?
Just the ground, the dirt ground, the hard dirt with a donkey blanket.
What did you eat every day?
Bread and water, mostly. Stale bread and dirty water.
Could you move around freely in that room?
No, I was chained up. I had, my wrists were chained and my ankles were chained.
For how long?
2 years straight.
What did they do to you?
Well, basically physical abuse. Beat with a chain, several occasions. Beat with a wire coax cable on several occasions. Kicked in the head more times than I can count. Just punched in the head more times than I can count. When I'm down on the ground, chained up. Just open palm, ear smacks. That was probably the worst.
All that time, 32 months, right? 32 months. Your mind goes to a lot of different places. What do you remember thinking about?
Besides meditating, I thought a lot about my childhood.
What did you think about?
A lot of places we visited.
What's our destination? Where are we going?
We'll go to the pond first.
In a snow-coated Lombard, Mark took me to those childhood spots he would visit in his mind.
Yeah, this is where I used to ice skate when I was a kid. Lombard Lagoon.
Really?
Yeah, it's not even a pond, it's a lagoon. It's not very deep. If you fell through the ice, you wouldn't drown. So it was safe. It's a carefree time when you're a child, you know? Maybe a way to distract myself.
Distract himself from his reality, held hostage in remote parts of Afghanistan. During Mark's isolation and captivity, he had no idea about the coronavirus pandemic, Russia's war in Ukraine, or that his government had brokered a deal to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan in 2021, a deal that did not include his release.
You are watching your country leave. What do you think?
Collateral damage. Do they even know I'm here? Do they even know I'm here?
As a cruel joke, his captors showed him videos of the U.S. pullout in August of 2021.
Last planes leaving.
The last U.S. planes leaving Afghanistan.
Last U.S. planes leaving.
Despite feeling abandoned by his country, Mark says he never let his fear show.
Yeah, I handled it like a trooper, so. You know, the 3 years, I never broke down and cried, never, you know, I came close, but I wasn't going to let them. They may have stole nearly 3 years of my life, but I wasn't going to let them steal my soul and spirit.
His response to your question, what did that room feel like? And he says evil. It speaks volumes. He was released in September of this past year, right?
Just this past year. Yeah.
What have the last 4 or 5 months been like for him?
I mean, just a whole new journey that's unimaginable in so many ways. I mean, Jeff, what this man endured is so staggering, and his strength and his fortitude are so impressive, right? That I think even more impressive for the efforts to release him, what his family went through and what he's going through now back at home. We're gonna get into all of that in part two tomorrow.
Can't wait to see it. The CDC is investigating a rise in severe cases of strep throat among kids in the U.S. Several children's hospitals across the country have reported an increase in strep cases since November, including in Colorado, where two children have died. The CDC has since issued an advisory warning of the surge of strep A among kids ages 5 through 15. For more on all this, I'm joined by Dr. Peter Hotez. He's the co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. It's great to have you here. And Dr. Hotez, the CDC investigating this strain of strep, what makes it so severe?
Well, the problem is it produces severe illness every year. Most parents know about it as a cause of strep throat, where pus appears on the tonsils, but it also can cause more invasive disease commonly, such as scarlet fever, what's called necrotizing fasciitis, toxic shock syndrome. And what the CDC is worried about is we're seeing an uptick in the number of those invasive streptococcal infections. It could also lead to rheumatic fever. And it's not only happening in the United States, it's also happening in Europe and Australia. So there's a concern that we're seeing a worldwide increase in this illness.
As we mentioned, at least two children in the U.S. have died. It's shocking to think that strep throat could be fatal. How do you characterize the risk?
Well, I think the point is we can treat it. The treatment is usually either oral amoxicillin or penicillin. We actually have an amoxicillin shortage right now. You can even get an intramuscular injection of what's called benzathine penicillin, even if you can't get amoxicillin. So the point is these cases should be preventable with early diagnosis and treatment. Parents are not often aware of it, but if you see an addition to your child struggling to swallow with high fever, that's a sign that there's severe strep throat that requires medical intervention. If you have a bright raised red rash all over the body, that's a sign. If you start seeing a cut or a bruise in your child and you start seeing streaking red rash around it, that's another tip off.
We are struggling with a season of horrible of viruses. You've got strep, COVID, flu, RSV, complicating things. Pharmacists and parents are struggling to find children's pain and fever-reducing medications, surpassing what we saw at the peak of the pandemic. How long do you expect that particular problem, the availability of kids' pain medication, to persist?
Well, in terms of the fever medication, remember, the fever is the body's natural response to these infectious agents. Kids do mount high fevers. So it's really important that parents closely monitor it. But of course, fevers can make kids uncomfortable. And so it's nice to treat it if you can. Hopefully, the supply chain management issues around these anti-fevers, anti-pain medications will start to subside fairly soon in the coming weeks. So it's just a matter of getting through these next weeks. But remember, if your child does have high fever and appears ill, you want to have, again, that low threshold for having that relationship with your pediatrician. And by the way, Jeff, I'm recommending to parents that they have that relationship. Don't wait till your child is sick in the middle of the night to suddenly start scrambling and looking for a phone number, trying to figure out where you take your child in the middle of the night. Have that plan worked out with your pediatrician ahead of time.
That's good advice. Parents in Ohio have experienced another unexpected threat to their children's health. It's a measles outbreak, dozens of hospitalizations. Many of those children, as I understand it, are unvaccinated, many of them young.
Yeah, that's right. Typically, we give the first measles vaccinations called MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine towards the end of the first year of life. My understanding is of the 80 plus cases, about more than 70, 75 have been unvaccinated. So this is, in many respects, a self-inflicted wound that all of these cases could have been prevented had those kids received the routine MMR vaccination. So what I'm really worried about, Jeff, is this a spillover from all of the anti-vaccine activism we saw really take off around COVID-19 vaccines for adults? Remember, the numbers are horrific. An estimated 200,000 Americans needlessly lost their lives because they refused a COVID vaccine, even after vaccines became widely available. And it's happening because of a rise in what I call anti-vaccine, anti-science aggression coming from activists. And now I think they're going to try to target all childhood immunizations. Measles is a deadly illness. In the year 2000, 500,000 kids, 500,000 kids died annually from measles. And now that number we've brought down below 100,000. I'm worried about a reversal of that, not only in the United States, but globally. And it's just a reminder that measles is nothing to trifle with. It is a serious illness and is one of the leading causes of death for kids under the age of five.
Dr. Peter Hotez, thanks as always for your time and for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff.
She's been called one of the most damaging spies in U.S. history. Ana Montes passed secrets and information to the Cuban government for almost 17 years until her arrest just days after the 9/11 attacks. After nearly two decades behind bars, she was released from prison on Friday. I recently spoke with Jim Popkin, who chronicled Montes's fascinating story in his new book, Codename Blue Wren. Jim Popkin, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So the book is Codename Blue Wren. Ana Montes is the center of this story. You have called her the most dangerous spy that most people have probably never heard of. How did you first hear about her? What made you want to tell her story?
So I heard about Ana Montes right when she was arrested, which was 10 days after 9/11. I was covering the FBI and Justice Department and 9/11 for NBC News at the time. I couldn't get to this story, but it really stayed with me. And I think a lot of people have never heard about her because of 9/11. It was obviously such a big distraction. But she's a very important spy in American history.
She led an impressive double life, right? So by day, she was actually a senior analyst for U.S. intelligence, a Cuba expert. And by night, she's passing secrets to the Cuban government. How did she do that?
She had two jobs. She had her real day job. She was a brilliant analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, which is kind of like the CIA equivalent for the U.S. military. She would keep her head down and memorize documents all day long, classified documents. And then her night job began in Washington, D.C., in her apartment. And she would basically upload what she had learned that day into an old Toshiba laptop, encrypt it, and then a couple weeks later, pass that information along to her Cuban handlers, whom she would meet at restaurants in Washington, D.C.
This is
fascinating detail to me about her family, because she had four family members who worked for the FBI, including her sister, Lucy, who, among her many specialties, was rooting out Cuban spies for the U.S. government, and no one knew anything.
It's amazing. It is absolutely amazing. Four family members, including her sister, her brother, who was an FBI special agent in Atlanta, sister-in-law, another special agent as well. And as you mentioned, Lucy was a translator in Miami. Most of her job pertained to drug cases in Miami in the 80s and 90s. But she got assigned to a special unit that was looking for Cuban spies. They were very successful. She had no idea. She's a very loyal, patriotic American. She had no idea that her sister was secretly the greatest spy in Cuban history.
You report that the FBI did know there was someone inside the U.S. government spying for Cuba at a very high level, right? How did Ana Montes eventually get caught?
It was actually first the National Security Agency that figured this out by decrypting communications between Cuba and the U.S. It ultimately lands with the FBI. They open a full-field investigation in late 2000. They got court authority to break into her apartment in 2001. And in her apartment, they go through her laptop, and she had very carelessly left communications messages with the Cubans, and it was clear that she was a spy. One of the messages said, "Thank you for providing the true identity of an American who was based in Havana." This is someone presumably working for the CIA. "We were waiting for him with open arms." As soon as the FBI saw that, they knew there was no doubt this is a Cuban spy.
You also document in some detail for the first time exactly how much damage she did with that spying. Yeah. What did she hand over?
Well, 17 years of providing documents, classified documents, the true identities of Americans operating overseas in Havana, the names of hundreds of people who worked on the Cuba account throughout the U.S. intelligence community, and then also secrets about a super secretive stealth satellite that the U.S. government operated and was working to spy on Russia, China, Cuba, and other adversaries. Ana learned about it, turned it over to the Cubans, and the Cubans have quite a track record of sharing that kind of information with Russia and other enemies. So it was a major national security disaster.
She is now being released after nearly two decades, right?
Correct.
Maximum security prison.
Right.
What does life look like for her now?
She'll be on probation for 5 years, but as she gets out, I just have to imagine she is going to keep her head low for a long time. She does not want to go back to this very tough prison where she's been held, as you said, Amna, for two decades. She is thought to be likely going to Puerto Rico, which is where her family is from, and she has some sympathetic relatives, and try to rebuild her life. But she's fortunate in this sense. She's only 65 years old. Most spies in this context go away for life. They're sent to Supermax and you never see them again. She's getting out at 65. She has a chance to maybe rebuild her life.
You think she might talk to you now that she's out?
I'm probably not top of her list, but I'm going to try.
Sure you will. The book is Codename Blue Wren. The author is Jim Popkin. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. Remember, there's a lot more online at pbs.org/newshour and on our Instagram, including a post about the Gulf Cup soccer tournament that has kicked off in Iraq for the first time since 1979.
We hope you'll join us back here again tomorrow night. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us.